Welcome back to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Recording on Thursday, February 4th, 2021. I'm Jeff O'Neill. I'm here with Rebecca Shinsky, and we come to you at it's kind of a momentous day in the history of books and reading, at least our little part of it.
It is.
It's hard to know how much it matters going forward, but it's a chance to look back, and that we're talking about the announcement this week that Jeff Bezos stepping down as CEO of Amazon, assuming the role of executive chairman of the board. We'll get a little wonky about governorship of corporations, because it does and doesn't matter a little bit. But it's a signal day, I think, in a lot of ways, and we'll get into that a little bit. But first, let's do our first sponsor break, and then we'll come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
You were off last week.
I was.
When Jen and I were talking about the new lawsuit brought against Amazon and then the big five publishers named as co-conspirators in an ebook price fixing lawsuit. Amazon's big enough now, and there's so many pies with so many fingers of such size that this kind of thing I don't think would precipitate Bezos stepping down the week after. But it's hard not to notice, at least. That context in mind.
Yeah, I think it's very tempting to think that the timing is connected. And then my second almost immediate thought is that Bezos is cannier than that. And if the reason he were stepping down is the lawsuit, I think he would wait a little while.
Yeah. Right.
Also, these transitions take a long time to plan, mm-hmm. and this probably had been planned for quite a while. And then maybe most importantly, this is not a man who is unfamiliar with being sued for things and accused of collusion.
Yes.
I don't. That experience has not yet prompted him to resign his post. So much as it would be a juicy story, I'm going to agree. I don't think that's what this was about.
But it does bring home, again, the centrality of Amazon. I mean, over the last 20 years, Amazon has been the story of books and reading. I think hard upon, or maybe right next to, on the business side, it's certainly Amazon. On the cultural, philosophical, creative, content side, it's about diversity and marginalization research. But those two stories have been the twin pillars of what the story of books and reading have been. Certainly over the last 7 years we've been doing the show, 6 years we've been doing the show, and then going back really until 99 or so when Amazon became a real force in the world of book selling. And it's this is water moment with how influential Amazon has been and what that company has done. Look, you can go crazy about stuff like this. I'm tempted to inflate the importance. There's a recency bias element here. But if you think about Audible, you think about Kindle, you think about selling books online, you think about Goodreads, some of these things they've bought, but there you go, and they've bought them. What an amazing, in all senses of the word amazing, disruptive, eruptive, constructive force Amazon has been on the world of books and reading. It's not Gutenberg, But I think in the fullness of time, it not might not be far behind, Rebecca. I don't know. I'm not sure how to think about that. I've never had occasion to sort of think about Amazon, the historical context of books, the codex, the written word, etc.
I think you're right. You know, the panic around the development of ebooks really mirrored the kind of panic that you see at disruptive moments around technology. And if you just map it onto the history of books and reading, you know, paperbacks were a disruption. And then, and prior to that, hardcovers, like the codex was seen as a disruption to the way that stories were passed on because people now were not gathered around telling them to each other. Clive Thompson does a really beautiful job of tracking all of this in a book from several years ago called Smarter Than You Think. That's fundamentally about, which we've talked about, but it's, I think it's been years on the show. Yeah. That's fundamentally about how technology doesn't actually make us dumber, at least not in the ways that we like to talk about. And there's usually a panic over any major disruption to the way that a thing is done, in the same way that like television was a major disruption to radio. And that also did not ruin the world, I don't think. I think you're right. I don't know that it's Amazon was the major disruption so much as that the development of digital reading was the major disruption and Amazon was the vector through which that really happened. Publishers weren't super incentivized to make a big deal of their ebooks for all the reasons that we've gone over in the last many years of the show, that they were concerned about protecting the margins, especially of hardcover books, and not cannibalizing those sales. And Amazon did not have that motivation, and they had the technology power to make ebooks become popular, and then they had the ability to use ebooks especially as loss leaders and to discount them. And the combination of all of those things was just incredibly powerful. And I do think that we owe the proliferation and the speed of the proliferation of e-reading technology to Amazon for sure.
Yeah, and some of it is the collection and consolidation of various new technologies and trends. Like Gutenberg himself did not invent everything in the tech stack that led to the printing press. I mean, you can go back, like, basically because of improvements in horticulture, grapes were brought further up from the Mediterranean, so there were grape presses around. Or was it olives? I can't remember. Either, but the presses came further north into Europe, so there was an available orthogonal move from, like, oh, look how they used those presses. I wonder if I put those presses on, you know, type with ink and paper, but ink and paper and type also had to be co-invented. So again, I think we sometimes oversimplify how these epoch-making technologies and transitions happen, but just because all the technologies that were there doesn't mean it was inevitable in that time and place that they would come together in that way. Another book, this is more of an academic book. I probably talked about this before on the show. Academic book by Walter Ong, who's a cultural historian. His book called Orality into Literacy blew my mind when I read it in graduate school. It was about the transition from oral cultures into writing cultures. You know, essentially, you've seen like probably versions of this in like, I don't know, a popular imagination one is in the movie 300, where Xerxes sends a messenger to Leonidas and the Spartans. And like, that's the word of the king, right? The messenger and the herald. And like, this is how you know the communication is legit. Well, then when rulers could start writing on pieces of paper, initially that was thought of, anyone could have written this.
Right.
I don't have the messenger telling me, and that's the king. Then you had to get the seal and everything else. But even literacy itself was thought of skeptically. And so every step along the way, everyone's like, have to be dragged, kicking and screaming into the future. And I think that's something Amazon did, is dragged publishing, kicking and screaming into the future because they made stuff readers wanted. Yeah, that's just the truth.
I think you're right. I think there's also, I can imagine a season of like an updated season of Halt and Catch Fire that starts like the year 2000, you know, that like now what we have is not the fight to convince people that they want personal technology. We've already done that. Most of them have computers in their homes, but that you want portable personal technology and that it's a phone and the technology around that starts to get developed, where everything gets smaller and more powerful. You have the ability to make the screens and the processors, and the internet has to be robust enough for it to work. And that all of those things were being developed at the same time that Jeff Bezos was building Amazon as a basically giant distributor of things. If that hadn't happened outside the walls of, you know, Amazon's offices, if people hadn't been working on all of those pieces of technology, they probably would have just continued to ship people paper books forever, which they're still happy to do. But he very intelligently saw the opening there of like, we could take these pieces of technology, we could deliver ebooks on them, and it was done more elegantly. Like, my first e-reader was a Sony device, and I don't remember now what the, and it was probably around like 2009 maybe. I don't remember the steps of the process, but it was incredibly complicated to get an ebook from the internet onto my Sony e-reader. And the technology that Bezos built up around the Kindle really enabled them to deliver in an efficient way. And it's that efficiency sort of all the way around. The efficiency and ease of use, regardless of what you're buying from Amazon, is the compelling thing about Amazon at this point.
That's right. And that ease of use, and I've never heard Bezos talk about this, and we should and will talk about the, you know, the darker, you know, what all of this has come at cost in a lot of different ways. And Amazon is by no means a perfect company. And Bezos has his own problems and blindnesses like any human does. But I think it's hard. It's easier to see now that the person who had maybe more faith than anybody else in the value of words that people read was Amazon, because they were basically saying the content is so important and so popular and so durable that it matters less what format it comes in than it gets to people, whether it's spoken in audio or digitally read or provided by a self-published author or bought in paperback at a discount or whatever, that reading can hold up to that kind of a change. When really for the conservative romantic reader didn't kind of believe that, and nor does publishing, and I think that's one thing we've been charting over time, is the heel dragging. And this year, if any, the durability, but also the flexibility of delivering words to people in a variety of formats, that kind of diversity of format has become really, really important. And I think it's enriched a lot of people's reading lives. It's always hard to know. You can't A/B test the universe. If we would have gotten something like this richness without the centrality and economic might of Amazon, I don't know. But one thing I know about Bezos is he did not care what the establishment said. And that's good if you're trying to make change. It also makes you an egoist, and you do things and you do break some things at the same time. Because some of those establishment things are like unions and healthcare and labor laws. And like, that's also part of it, right? It's very hard. You can't take one without the other.
Right, I think
so that's important to say.
It really is important to say that that's a real double-edged sword, and they are features and bugs of each other, that you can't have one without the other. You can't have someone who disrupts at that level. Like, it requires a real, like, confidence, arrogance, maybe both, to believe.
Sometimes we call it vision. Yeah. I think sometimes that's just arrogance. Recast differently.
Right. Arrogance with a little shine on it. Yeah. To believe that your idea is really that powerful, and that you can execute it and change the world. And people who have that kind of wiring are also pretty confident that they can disrupt a whole bunch of other things in the process, like unions and healthcare and, you know, safe working environments. And
entire mechanisms of infrastructure.
Like, I think that it's that we feel like we've had Amazon forever, and it has been around for many years, but it continues to be so disruptive in new ways that we don't have any real perspective yet. Like, being able to tell the story of the changes Amazon created in American society or in world culture, I think that's a job for the 2030s, you know, or beyond. It's just hard to get our heads around. And I think because we're still in the middle of it in so many ways. And you're right that he had really deep faith in the durability of people's interest in the written word. And I understand why the jump from all the varieties of paper book to e-reading felt in the moment like a more significant break than, you know, the development of paperbacks themselves or anything like that. I think in hindsight, the change in format itself is actually not meaningful. Reading an ebook does not feel meaningfully different, really, from getting the information in your brain by holding a paper book or by listening to an audiobook, for that matter. And, you know, I produced an episode of Annotated about did technology kill reading, and the scientific conclusion has been no. I think really it's that technology changes how we interact with the world so much. And that's also part of the Bezos situation, too. Amazon is not a book-selling company. They're not really a distributor. No. I think that most correctly we should talk about Amazon as a technology company, and that they're looking for ways to make money innovating with technology. And first was selling things on the internet, then it was selling selling internet things on the internet and delivering them with the internet. And
well,
then
it powers
the internet. And that's, yes. I think that leads nicely into the fact that Bezos' successor is coming from Amazon Web Services.
They sell the internet. They use the internet to sell the internet to other people.
And then so they sell you the ability to make internet where you can sell stuff.
I know. It's an amazing... I mean, again, there will be books written for as long as people care about corporations. I mean, people still write about GE. They write about Ford. They write about companies that stopped... I mean, I know because I've read a lot of these boring books that I find fascinating. And you're right. We're in the middle of this story. It's like trying to get a sense of Gutenberg's important while Gutenberg was still alive. Like, you just couldn't do it at the same time. But it gives us a chance to stop and reflect. And what, if anything, does it mean for our little corner of Amazon's empire? I think it's telling, as you said, that the person taking his gig comes from web services. I think that's extremely, extremely telling. It's not coming from the many tentacled octopus of retail, right? Direct to consumer retail, which it easily could. It's not the Amazon Prime Video people. It's not someone from, it's not, you know, whoever's in charge of Alexa.
Or Whole Foods.
It's not someone that comes from their distribution. Yeah, or Whole Foods or their distribution empire, something like that. Amazon Web Services, in terms of profit margin, is their most profitable business because they're selling... Anytime you can sell electrons, you're better off than selling atoms. It's an old adage. Well, it's an old adage that's been around since technology was around, essentially. But like, it costs them way less to deliver Amazon Web Services to clients because they, you know, don't have to put it in a box and ship it to Sheboygan if no one wants to buy it there. I think there's... Some of the elegance of the business model now is they needed internet scale that didn't exist, so they built it, and then they were the low-cost producer of internet for the internet to buy from them, which is a remarkable hat trick to pull off. It's like pulling a rabbit out of another rabbit.
Right. It is. And I have no evidence for this. It's just a gut feeling that I think if Amazon could get out of the selling physical objects and delivering them business, they would. That the margins on making technology and selling technology and building the backbone of the internet is like that really is where the money is, because the overhead is so minimal. Like, think about how much all those warehouses must cost them.
I know.
And the trucks and the boxes and all of that stuff that makes retail a lower margin business, especially if you're a retailer who's driven by discounts and then by having to pay for speedy delivery of things. Mm-hmm. Like, I do think that this is a signal about Amazon's near to midterm priorities and strategy.
Yeah, Clint, our colleague here at BookRite, we were talking about it because he was excited to hear what we were going to say about it, and we're like, it's hard to read too much into it. You know, what does it mean for Amazon? I think the only thing we know now, Amazon also had a blowout quarter, as you might expect in the fourth quarter of a pandemic year. The table was set sort of unbelievably, terrifyingly beautiful for Amazon to do its thing this year, but the web services person taking over, again, he could have, this guy could have just demonstrated exceptional executive acumen. You know, you don't get to that job either. Remember, probably that company alone is one of the 500 biggest companies in the world, that division. Right. So it's not like it's just somebody that was sitting around waiting to
They're
get
not just
off
like
the bench.
Promoting Dave from accounting or something.
No. Yeah. Like the 20th most influential person at Amazon would be like the CEO of any Fortune 500 company easily. But I think it's interesting to think about what it might mean that Bezos is stepping away, because he's not old by any stretch of the imagination. He could have stepped away long ago if it was, I have enough money. And at the very least, I think you can sort of abstract it and say, whatever is the case is right now, Bezos is interested. Something else is more interesting to him than Amazon, which I think is interesting actually for itself. Because I was thinking about, you know, think about your Apples, your Googles, your Facebook, your Netflix, or you know, the FANG companies, as it's called in investing, right? Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google, right? Which has powered so much of the American stock market, but also world technological blitz over the last 5 to 10 years. Which of them has the most interesting future from right now? I think Amazon I would put last myself, because I feel like it's kind of done the thing. Like, what's the next interesting Amazon thing you can think of? Like, for example, Apple's like thinking about a headset, thinking about a car. You know, Facebook is growing still. You know, it's a mess. They've got a lot of work to do. That, like, Zuckerberg's legacy is very much in doubt, I guess, is one thing I would say about Facebook over there. Google has a bunch of these. It's now Alphabet. It's not even called Google anymore. And it's got this, all these other things that it's interested in. It's really playing in a different way. Netflix is right in the middle of the war. But they're in the middle of this streaming war. And who does that lead? I guess that's it. And like, what's the next thing Amazon could do that's fascinating to me? Yeah, I can't think of anything, Rebecca. Can you? I mean,
no,
do you see where I'm going with this?
I can't either. And that's sort of the line I've been taking as well, thinking about why now for Bezos. Right. And my best guess is he's done and bored, or at least more interested in something else. And if you reflect on like the other big technologies of the last couple decades, Amazon tried to be part of all of those. Like, all, you know, they were the ones who started it with the Kindle and e-reading. That was the big splash. But when iPhones were taking off, they tried a Kindle phone. That did not work, or the Fire Phone, I think it was called. Like, that wasn't a thing. They've tried to compete in the other ways. Amazon streaming is sort of like now regularly derided as, you know, that Amazon's streaming services have the lowest quality content or the least amount of interesting content relative to Netflix and Hulu and Apple and Disney and, you know, all the other players. They aren't competing in the other big ways right now. And I think building the backbone of the internet is a reliable way to keep making money. And the internet only gets bigger and bigger. More people make websites and are finding ways to connect. You can stay in business for a long time providing web services and focusing on those kinds of things. But I don't think that's terribly exciting in terms of
it's a commodity, right?
Yeah,
I mean, isn't that interesting? I don't know that it's much more than a commodity.
It's just a thing that exists in the world now. I don't see a lot of headroom for Amazon to keep making big splashes. And maybe after running the company for this long, Bezos has come to that conclusion as well. Like, we have made our name, and now it's more about steady as she goes and staying in business and like smaller incremental changes rather than trying to make big disruptive ones would sort of be my guess about the direction of the company. I'm more interested, I think, really in how the profile of Amazon changes as Bezos is less of a part of the conversation. Like, he is so, and for, I think, very good reasons, aligned in the press and in many of our sort of ways of thinking about Amazon and the internet as this person who has maybe questionable morals. I'm not going to go so far as to say that he's evil. His businesses definitely make decisions that I don't care for. I don't know him as a human being. But he's so closely tied to the brand, and criticism of him is so closely tied to criticism of Amazon, and also for very good reason. But it's kind of like, you know, Tim Cook is a lot less visible at Apple than Steve Jobs was. And we don't talk about Apple all that much anymore. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that's what's going to happen with Amazon as well. And as Bezos recedes from the picture, like maybe we'll continue to talk about Amazon's corrupt practices. And I actually think that that would be a more productive conversation.
I think so too. Could, I agree with you.
That could lead to real change. Like that's a much more effective criticism, I think, than Jeff Bezos is a bad person, so we should take his company down. Like let's actually look at the company's practices. How is the company violating policy? And I know this might sound like semantics, but I do think that the PR around these things matters. And then if you want to get widespread sort of movement or motion behind the idea of disengaging from Amazon or being less reliant on Amazon, messaging it all around how Bezos is a bad dude is not nearly as effective as look at what this company does. And previous efforts to move consumers away from other companies with bad practices have been successful by focusing on the practices and the company, not the one guy.
Yeah, as he functions as a lightning rod, both for good and for ill. Gets a lot of the shine, as mm-hmm. you said, for the company's rise, but also is a useful receptacle of critique. And if he sloughs it off, and everyone, you know, it's such an enterprise now that he cannot reasonably or even possibly be informed and involved in every kinds of even meaningful decision Amazon makes all the way down through its subsidiaries, right? So focusing on the local, focusing on the actual action, rather than here's a thing Amazon does, boy, I hate Bezos, really evacuates a lot of the energy about change.
For a company that size, you have to assume that he's completely unaware of the vast majority of decisions that are made any day.
Right. That's right. That's right. Because, you know, the CEO at the level, I mean, hundreds of thousands of employees selling billions of products and millions of transactions mm-hmm. a month just can't be. Like, he's probably doing all he can to manage the seven people that report to him, who themselves giant corporations.
We have 15 full-time staff, and there are dozens of decisions made every week that, like, not only do I not know what the decision was, I don't even know it took place.
Right. I don't even know what I don't know.
Yeah, I don't even know that conversation's happening. I can't imagine the scale of it in a company like Amazon. And I think it misses the point to align Bezos so closely with it. In a way, it's smart strategy. And I wouldn't put it past him to let himself be the lightning rod and know that that distracts from productive movement against Amazon itself.
That's right. When he shaved his head back in 2004, whenever that was, he's like, I'm just going Lex Luthor.
Like the name Elon Musk was already taken. So I'll just.
I got to be the bald Bond villain at this point. I'm not sure what else there's to say. Again, as you're in the water, but I think it's a good moment to sort of stick our heads up out of the sand a little bit and say, wow, what for good and for ill. A figure unlike any other in my lifetime, or it's hard to think of an equivalent figure in books and reading in the 20th century or the 21st century. I mean, maybe Bennett Cerf at Random House or something like that. It's very difficult to come up with something else. Now, I mean, in 1995, or 96, 97, the industry boogeyman was Len Riggio.
Right.
How many people even know who the hell that is now, Rebecca? Like, it's you and me and, like, some people that were at Bloomsbury in the 90s, or, you know, like, publishing old-timers now, now even know what it is at this point. But also interesting, I think, to say books last year, we don't have it on the agenda today, the Big Five sold more units last year than ever before, mm-hmm. almost 1 billion units in the traditional publishing world. And that doesn't include all the self-publishing things, which exploded over last year. So in terms of and that doesn't include library lending and digital lending, which also had a banner year. Like in terms of words that people bought, borrowed, and read, it could have, just books, forget about the internet. I'm putting all the internet out there. Like the old things that would be a book by any other name at this point, probably as read in America in aggregate as any year ever. Which I don't know that people, if you would have told people that in 2008, when were we at the height of Amazon concern? Because I think we're past the peak of Amazon, like 2011, 12, somewhere
in there,
maybe?
Yeah, I think we were at the height of Amazon / ebook disruption concern around 2011, 2012.
If you would have told people that in 10 years, not only that independent bookstores will still be around in a pandemic, but more books will have been sold and more will have been borrowed than at any point in American history. They would have said, how did that happen? How did that happen?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point that I don't want to get lost in the bigger conversation about Amazon, especially that we've had the internet for long enough now that I think we can rest in the durability of humans' interest and desire and need to have stories, and how we get those stories, how we get access to the written or printed or digitally manifested word has evolved, but the internet has not killed books and reading, not anywhere close to it. There may be some future technology that does it. I don't know. But I think that we're far enough now into having the internet and having personal internet devices and being able to read on screens to know that this actually is something portable, that how we tell the story, the device, the manner of delivery of the story is much less important than just the persistent need that humans have for stories. And there will be something else, like who knows when it will be or how long it will take us to get there, but there will be some future evolution in technology and in how books and stories get delivered. And I'm confident that when that happens, there will be another panic that this will be the thing that ruins it. So far, that hasn't happened. And that's not to say it never will. But I think we need to be done now. And maybe this moment of Amazon transition can mark the doneness with the hand-wringing over what's going to happen to books because of the internet. Because what we've seen is that even in a global pandemic where maybe getting your hands on physical books was difficult, people were still deeply invested in getting them. Many independent bookstores had their communities rallying around them to purchase books and keep those businesses open. This is a thing humans care about. Amazon has done a lot of stuff that changed the business. How that all shakes out in the publishing story in the long term remains to be seen. And as we've said, like, there are very valid criticisms to make of Amazon's business practices. But in terms of like Amazon ruined reading or is going to ruin reading, no. Amazon might ruin the existing business models of some other, you know, book selling modes. And I would personally be sad to see that happen, but how we our access to books has not decreased and our hunger for them hasn't decreased either. And I think those sales numbers are a really powerful example of that.
Yeah, the format doesn't seem to matter. But I mean, I think that's what we've learned now. You're right. Some, you know, VR headsets have smell-o-vision or whatever, who knows. But the format doesn't seem to matter. As of today, Amazon.com with a market capitalization of 1.6 trillion with a T, trillion dollars. It and Apple have been back and forthing for a little bit over the last year about being the most valuable company ever to have existed in the history of the world, which is saying something. All because Bezos identified books as being especially amenable to online distribution because there were so many damn numbers of them that no bookstore, physical bookstore, even the giant ones, could keep them all in stock and service them, nor was it easy to find them. And so the internet, with its infinite browsable shelves and ability to deliver through the post office, meant that you could have big warehouses and have all the books ship right from distributors in local locations and have overnight, essentially, the world's biggest bookstore and sell them for cheaper. You can certainly, they use them as a loss leader to get people to say, hey, I can buy stuff on Amazon, but you can even sell them at a profit online in a way that other bookstores can't. So it wasn't a ideological, philosophical, he wasn't thinking, you know, boy, I'm really going to stick it to the hoi polloi of the world of books and reading by making this happen. It was a very cagey identification of a business opportunity, and that books were ripe for someone to come in to try a different business model. Mike Schatzkin, who I talked to on an episode of Annotated, said, you know, the history of book retailing has been who can get the right book to the right person at the right time the fastest. And it's a little hard to imagine we'll do better then I can get it on my phone now. At any given moment. Let's take another sponsor break. We'll come back. I guess it's interesting to me that I'm going to skip LeVar for a minute. I'm going to come back and do a Hero of the Week and skip down to Reese Witherspoon's wildly popular book club is now an app. This is a piece by Stephanie Mehta on Fast Company. I meant to download this yesterday and play around with it before today. I didn't get around to it, but it did strike me as an interesting counterpoint to the stagnation in Amazon's book lineup, right? Really, since they bought Goodreads, when was the last interesting thing they really did around books? Whereas Reese Witherspoon's book club is trying to fuse celebfluencing, I don't even know what the word, celebfluencing with a social network, right? Around a niche topic, which is the conveyance of several streams that I think are all extraordinarily interesting. It's a new mobile app that will allow in-app purchases of books and exclusive merchandise. So it's retail built around largely what has been an Instagram community. I think this is wildly fascinating. Mm-hmm. I don't care about it myself, but I find it really, really interesting. Rebecca, am I wrong? How are you feeling about what's here?
I'm also really interested in it. And I don't know that I would have made this connection if we weren't talking about Amazon news this week. Mm-hmm. But I think the fact that, you know, that Amazon left Goodreads to their own devices in running Goodreads after they acquired it largely, and then Goodreads didn't really make many changes to the interface, left the door wide open for someone to do this. Like, Goodreads' functionality sort of declined over time, and it's become more, I've seen more widespread, like, criticism or complaining about how Goodreads works. It's really interesting. I think, you know, Reese Witherspoon's rise to celebfluencer, which is weird and hard to say, and being a person whose taste in books the public trusts and is invested in, like, it really is on par with how Oprah was in the 90s and the early 2000s in terms of, like, the picks are consistently good enough that readers trust her to keep picking things. And they have a sense that Reese's selections drive book sales, even though, of course, we don't get any real data about, like, before and afters of that, and these huge communities that have built up. And I think it's really smart that someone was like, you know, instead of having all of our interaction happen on Instagram where we don't have any control, let's create an app where we can control the environment, allow community to happen. There are going to be, you know, discussion sections. I think there's even eventually going to be events and meetups. Like, you could go talk about the Reese's pick with other people in your town. So that's an interesting thing to see. You can buy the book through links that are in the app. And honestly, I think that if this were an announcement by a really popular, powerful man in his mid-50s who's made a name not just in recommending books but in, like, very cannily and with good taste snagging the film rights to them, developing films and TV series that perform very well, and giving themselves starring roles in those things and earning praise, like, Reese Witherspoon is very stealthily doing a whole thing around using the power of her influence to connect books and her movie business. And it seems stealthy because she's a blonde woman with a Southern accent. This is really very smart.
Yeah, the pink cardigan selfie is it's dissembling in a way of how cagey the whole thing is. And maybe as much an expression of my own bias about what I recognize as cagey. But there's an informality, right, to a conversationality, a informality, a humanness that's brought to bear, I think, of some of which draws people to Witherspoon herself and then her book club in particular. She seems herself, really, to enjoy books and reading, and clearly becomes part of something she cares about. I think she is as close as we have now to the Oprah we once did in terms of influence about books and reading. Oprah didn't care to continue it. So it leads me to wonder, what does success look like for Reese Witherspoon at this point in this? What does the book club app thing give her that she didn't have before? Is it the commerce parts? Like, well, you might as well buy from Reese's Book Club, easy to buy here in special editions, and I can get my Reese's Book Club swag and all that kind of stuff is too. I guess one of the other things that Amazon did in commoditizing book buying was, I do think, leave open some space for the curative part, right? The retailing, or the curation part. The curation and retail pieces in the form of bookstores, independent bookstores going all the way back, were hand in glove. But if you take those things apart, right, if it's no longer required for you to be a curator and have a store, a literal store that people come into, is the business of curation itself a business? And I don't think we've answered that question yet, Rebecca. I haven't even seen this really happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this might be part of getting the answer to it. You know, one of the other selling points of the app, it's the very first thing listed on the features, is that you get to be part of the announcements of the new picks, so that you can pick up a copy or reserve your copy at the library before everyone else wants the title.
Fascinating.
Which I think is very true. That happens with the Reese's Book Club picks. And anecdotally, we see a lot of mentions of Reese's Book Club in profiles that come in for the TBR service, where people either say, I read all the Reese's Book Club books and things like those are what I want you to recommend me, or I read all the Reese's Book Club books, so make sure you're not sending me those. It's really very popular. And there, I think, Reese Witherspoon and Tom Hanks kind of go together in my head, and in the way that we trust Tom Hanks because he seems genuinely invested in the thing that he's doing, and he's also very good at making it make money for himself. Yeah, I think we're seeing that.
Earnestness is part of the brand for both of them.
Yeah, exactly. That I think she genuinely loves books, and part of the mission of the book club is to advance diverse voices, and I think she genuinely cares about that, and you can see it in the casting of her shows and movies. You can see it in her work to elevate women in the world of Hollywood, which is just an ongoing struggle. So it's very cagey, but cagey's not a bad thing. It's very smart. She's good at this, and she has figured out ways to make it profitable. And also, not for nothing, once you own the app and everyone's email addresses, you have all kinds of access. So I will not be surprised if there start being ads for sponsored items to Reese's Book Club, or publishers paying to give their books away to a select number of Reese's Book Club winners. This has a lot of opportunity, and I think I would be very surprised if this thing ran its course without the members ever being used as recipients of advertising.
No, I mean, there's
which is fine.
They're not doing this for
it's not to be nice.
Yes, it's not altruistic, right? It's a service, and people have a right to make some money. They got to pay the VP of whoever that's quoted here. They got to earn a living somehow. Reel me this back, girl. Is it impressive that Reese's Book Club has 2 million Instagram followers? And I'm stacking the deck, knowing that Reese herself has 25 million Instagram followers. What do you think about that function? I mean, in itself, it is impressive. 2 million followers for a book club on Instagram is impressive. But that's less than 10% of her followers. I just find that interesting.
Yeah,
right? I don't know what else to do with that.
Well, I mean, I haven't looked in a while, so I don't know the percentage of the population that's on Instagram now, but I think there are a lot of people who interact with the Reese's Book Club picks without using Instagram, or they're just looking for the sticker on the book at their bookstores, or they hear about it from their book club or wherever. I wonder, I'm sure they'll never tell us, but I'm interested about, after 6 months, how many active users does this app have? It's really hard. I get why they tried it. I think if you have built this kind of community and you see that kind of receptivity around your ideas, you kind of have to wonder, what would it be like if we built our own sandbox and invited all these people into it? The big question for me is, will people actually do it? Do people want to go onto an app and talk about Where the Crawdads Sing with strangers, or are they totally happy just letting...
Talk about a nightmare.
I mean, for you and me.
Yes.
You are the only person in the world I wanted to talk about Where the Crawdads Sing.
And even that was a 50-50 proposition.
Yeah. Or like, are they satisfied just with her as a curator?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting question, but I completely understand why they feel the need to get the answer to that question.
Oh, totally agree. I think, if I haven't said, I think this is a really good idea to try. I don't know if it's going to succeed. I don't know what success looks like, but if the matriculation from following Reese herself to the book club is 1.9, will you see a similar sort of matriculation rate down to another 10% of those people? All right, you're looking at 190,000 users. Sounds like a lot. Not for nothing. That's one day of bookriot.com per month.
Right.
Which, we have a business. It's great. But I'm not sure Reese Witherspoon is looking at one day of us and be like, I want in on that act. I mean, it's like, I don't know. I'm just not sure. So maybe they hope to grow it from there. Maybe they're wondering about the commerce bit. I don't really have a good sense of the strategy. And I'd like to play around with it a little bit more. But I think they are trying. They've got heat around Reese's book club. How do you channel that into something is really hard. It's really hard. It's really, really hard to figure out what to do with that. Though I think if I had to bet money on someone figuring it out, I would think it would be them. Because we've seen, I mean, I've talked in sales meetings about, publishers always ask us about, well, we love book clubs. You know, maybe Book Riot should do a book club. And we've done our own kinds. And we've seen, more than anything, though, we've seen other publications try online book clubs. Mm-hmm. And let me just say, I can't name any that's still around that I care about that do anything interesting. That the book club idea doesn't seem to be super portable to the internet and at scale. The book club, as we think about it, is like, let's be honest, 7 to 10 women, generally speaking, sitting around talking about a book like Reese Witherspoon is picking, doesn't seem at this moment in time to have an external reference online. That's not people on Zoom doing the same thing in the pandemic. To have some, I think the book club term itself is super telling about why it works in at a home and why it doesn't on the internet. Will this break out of that? I would love to find out. I'm very interested to see.
It is a great question, and no one has successfully adapted it, like that discussion, robust discussion of books, I think, to the online platforms that exist. If you have like 5,000 people, remember when Mark Zuckerberg had a book club on Facebook? Remember that?
Yeah, and I do.
That I remember looking at the comments of it for the first couple selections.
Oh, God.
And it becomes a disaster super quickly, because moderating a conversation where like 5,000 people are all commenting at the same time is not a conversation. And then Slack became a thing that exists in the world, and lots of people are used to communicating by Slack. But even if you added like a Slack to Reese's book club, it's almost impossible to moderate. And a Slack with 5,000 people in it is still just a bunch of posts on the internet that actual conversation, like you're going to have at book club, becomes really difficult. So I think like maybe the closest you could get is if you built something like this and you were like, when you sign up, you will be randomly assigned to a discussion group of 8 people, and you and those other 7 people will have like
Lost. It's like Lost in a seminar room after hours. Like, oh my God.
Yeah,
Rebecca,
like I don't want to experience that, but it's the way that you would get like the small group and the discussion, you know, could actually feel like a conversation. It feels to me like book clubs, as they exist in people's homes and around tables at coffee shops, are one of the things that are just really resistant to online adaptation. And I think that the fact that we see like Reese's book club really just means a bunch of people reading the book that Reese recommends. Oprah's book club.
Yeah, it's picks and a vibe, right? That's what the Reese book club is. It's like picks and a vibe.
It is. Like, and there's maybe a sense of identity or connection to be part of that. At the same time, it's so broad, I think intentionally and for smart reasons on their part. But like, if you were at a party back in the time of life when parties were a thing that we went to, and you're chatting with someone and they're like, oh yeah, I'm a Reese's book club person, or I'm an Oprah's book club person, that doesn't really tell you much beyond this person likes books.
It's the new mainstream. It's the new middle brow. I mean, and I don't use that derogatively. I love middle brow.
Yeah,
give me some middle brow.
Not enough
information. But this is the new stand. This is the new median.
Yeah,
I guess,
there's not enough information there. Just the shared affinity for Reese's books is not enough information about like our shared affinities as human beings for why we should have a connection to each other.
Yeah. I would love, if there's an academic paper out there or a long think piece in like the Atlantic or something about the what makes for an ideal Witherspoon book club picks. And I don't mean this snarkily because I think the books are very good. I've read and like most, if not all of the ones that I've read that she's picked. So it's not snobbery or looking down, but it feels like there is a, you know, like when they have to, they have to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere. They always say there's like a thing the size of a piece of paper. Like it does feel like there's a narrowish but interesting gap. Like that's where the space is that's identifiable. Like the vibe I can kind of get, but I can't quite articulate. I had this question for you. We're running out of time here, and we want to get to LeVar in just a minute, at least as a shout out. But I am surprised what isn't here in this app, at least what I've read about so far. Any thoughts about, you want to play Guess What Jeff's Thinking, or as I like to call it, Welcome to My Podcast, Rebecca? any idea what I'm surprised isn't here? I've got two major ones and a couple of other minor ones.
Are you surprised that they aren't running their own bookstore?
Well, I don't know how the e-commerce is. I'm surprised there's not a Book of the Month Club equivalent. Like, there's not a sub. There's not a subscription where you get every month, you get Reese's. I'm surprised that's not there. That's number two on my list.
The e-commerce is buy the book on Google Play, Bookshop, Libro, Amazon, or Barnes & Noble.
Right. So it's just affiliates? They're getting affiliate shit from that?
Yeah, here,
it seems small potatoes.
Let me just click on one.
You're looking at your phone right now. Okay, great.
Oh, no, I'm looking at the internet, but just clicking on, like, I clicked on a title. I'm like way down this URL and I am not. Oh, there it is. Yes, it's affiliate. I was like waiting to see the affiliate tag. Yeah, they're just getting affiliate.
Oh, we know stuff. It's affiliate stuff.
I guess it makes sense
because they also can't, what they're trying to do, they want to make interesting picks. They care about diversity. But they also can't make too many decisions about the retailing spots because then you start to fragment. If you make it only Amazon, have fun. That's going to be great. If you don't include Amazon, have fun. That's going to be great. No, the number one thing, when you think about, you want the book club, you want the vibe, you want the picks and the hang, why is there not a Reese Witherspoon book club podcast on Spotify? Surely someone at Spotify said, Reese, come on and host your book club podcast. This is what people want. The things that people like about podcasts and the things they like about book clubs, I think there's overlap there. They like the community, the conversation, and the intimacy of feeling like you are, I'm not even sure a book club, some people want to talk, but a lot of people want to be a part of the hang. And I think you could transmit the hang of Reese's book club in a podcast form. I'm very surprised they didn't do this.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I think you are correct. It's really interesting that that's not on the table, especially as I've seen other just popular podcasts start to sort of journey into the book club-y kind of thing. Like, for reasons I can't go into because we're near the end of the show, I found myself listening to Tim Ferriss's podcast at the end of the holidays.
And you keep teasing that we're going to have to talk about that at some point. So we better get out of our system at some point.
He has, authors on occasionally. And Hillary Clinton had Louise Penny on one episode of her podcast because they're friends and they talked about the importance of books and stories. And I think for the most part, author interviews are like the most boring way of talking about books. But the hang of a book club, like if Michelle Obama did a book club episode on her podcast and it was her and some of the women that she's had on the show having a conversation about the book and like maybe the author gets to come on for a little while. Cool. Also, if the author never appeared, that would be equally cool.
Also like, cool. Yes.
Yeah, Brené Brown has authors on her show and it's mostly like they're kind of book clubbing it together, how the book got made and what's significant going on there. You're right. That would have been a really good idea. I'm so interested in why they don't have it.
Because if you would have told me, because when I saw this news, and if the only thing it was a Patreon podcast, I would be like, that makes sense. I would be like, that would be, again, I like podcasts. You're listening to one right now. So you know that sometimes there's a bit of a hammer nail situation for how I think about content. Like, what do I like and what would I do? I just feel like you could get hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of people to pay $2 a month to listen to The Hang. I think that feels an easier monetization strategy if that's what they care about. And again, I don't know exactly what their goal is here. But that would be something people would pay. Reese talking about the books with who, it doesn't matter. And I don't
maybe,
think.
I don't know. Maybe they have it planned and it's like a thing that will become available in the app later on.
Yeah.
That would be a way to make this app. Like, it's a free app. You can access the book picks for free. Like, the only money that currently it looks like they can make inside the app is if you buy one of the books by clicking the link while you're inside the app, and they get the affiliate revenue. So I think at some point they're going to monetize in some fashion. Yeah. And you can only sell so many Reese's Book Club tote bags, which I assume will also be a thing.
Yeah, right. Because the one thing that people in the world of books and reading don't have enough of is tote bags. Yeah, and some of this could be a stake in the ground. They want to see how many people download this. What do they do? Maybe they don't want it to be. There's a minimum viable product here. That is, come sign up, get early. I think the early access to the library picks is a great idea. We've done things like, here's what you should put on hold at the library now before they're out. Someone wrote in this. We didn't do listener feedback. I'm collecting some, but someone wrote in to talk about the survivors. When they heard us talk about it, like, I want to go put it on on the hold list, you know, right when we talked about it. And they were already number 197.
Oh my gosh.
On their hold list for the Survivors by Jane Harper. I was going to go get on the hold list. Then I was going to buy an ebook, but then I balked because it was freaking $14.99 for the ebook, and it was $18.95 to get a hardcover. And I haven't made a decision yet. I'm paralyzed by fury.
I downloaded the galley for free.
Yeah, see. You 1%ers. You galley 1%ers.
You have my Edelweiss login.
But I choose not to use it, Rebecca.
Well, it's not my problem.
Let's do our last sponsor and talk about LeVar for a minute. LeVar, your friend, colleague, I'd say confidant even.
I mean,
too strong?
One time my face touched his face, so we're basically besties.
That's right. Figures as much. Tell me about LeVar, Rebecca. Take us home by telling
LeVar
us about
LeVar Burton was named this week as the inaugural Penn Faulkner Literary Champion, which I like this name for an award. Mm-hmm. it's going to be a new annual, they're calling it a commendation, which that's just a pleasing word also. Right, commendation. Like, you feel fancy if someone's going to give you a commendation.
It feels better than award too, right? Because it's not like trophy hunting, like it's commendation. It's nice.
Syllables. That's just a good word. Anyway, it will every year recognize devoted literary advocacy and a commitment to inspiring new generations of readers and writers. He's going to be honored in a virtual ceremony on May 10th, which is at the same time that the Penn Faulkner Award winner, which is the 40th year of that, is going to be announced. And if you're setting out to honor each year a person who's working to inspire generations of readers and writers, I don't think there's a better first choice.
You can shut it down after this, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. LeVar Burton, all-time literary champion.
Yeah, I think this is a cool award. I think it's very smart because no one cares about the Penn Faulkner Award. Or they do.
Oh, interesting.
I think people who do, but more people care about books care about LeVar Burton. So if he's going to be the champion and that gets him to be the thing that hosts the thing on Zoom or whatever that picks the Knockout Queen by Ruffy Thorpe, which is one of the finalists here, that brings more heat to the thing.
If that's the strategy, it'll be interesting to see who they find next year.
I think they also should rename the Penn Faulkner thing. Like, the slash isn't not working for me anymore.
No.
Call it the Penn Award or the Faulkner. Just choose a lane here. Slashes are...
You know what? They should
not
just...
postmodernist graduate school.
We should rename everything now as a commendation.
The LeVar?
Sure. The 2021 commendation for fiction.
I like that. Quickly, before we get out of here, who are the next three draft picks for the commendation? Who would be the next three?
Generations.
I mean, Oprah's, I think, I think Oprah's next.
I think
could have been first.
Yeah, generations of readers and writers. You've got to go Oprah. I think prior to the last couple years, J.K. Rowling could have had a spot on that list.
Yep,
but no longer.
No longer.
Ooh, somebody else who writes like really enduringly
Stephen
popular
King?
Children's books.
Stephen King
would be good. James Patterson, honestly. For his advocacy work would be a candidate.
Jill Biden.
Nora Roberts. Laura Bush.
Interesting one. Amanda Gorman, who's now going to be performing at the Super Bowl.
She gets
performing at the Super Bowl.
All the commendations for all the things forever. We're done.
I saw something else that it was like another thing. I was like, oh, that makes sense. It's just like she's going to own Ford Motor Company. You could tell me anything now about them, and I was like, sure, why not? Let's do it.
I mean,
sounds good to me.
It is not a small feat to go on national television at the biggest political event of 4 years and make poetry cool.
We didn't get to talk about it. Jen and I did spend a minute on it. I'm not sure if you listened to us, but like I know you were as blown away as I was at that moment. Yeah, Amanda, yeah, that's interesting to think about that on the artistic side, on the cultural side, I don't even know what you would... Reese? I mean,
I don't
insane
think she has
at
the
all.
Longevity yet.
No. In 20 years, maybe?
Sure.
Maybe. It's not a long list, I guess.
Yeah,
there's not a huge list. Once you can start dipping into the author well, which you could do for a long time, you get your George Martins or whatever, but like, I don't think it's a super long list.
You know, maybe they're out of the gate with a very fancy first selection like LeVar Burton to draw attention to it, but Penn Faulkner tends to be a little more industry inside baseball-y, I think.
Yes.
And you could get a lot of mileage here out of honoring like editors and publishers that have done groundbreaking or important work.
But that means you're not as cynical as I am, which we're using the celebrity spotlight to like get the halo effect accidentally pays attention to the
I believe that
here.
They're using the celebrity spotlight this year. If they intended to do that every year, I think that they maybe failed to consider really how few people will qualify.
Yeah, right. So, it's like we're through four and we're done. Wow.
Right. And so I'm trying to, for once, I'm having a generous interpretation. I'm trying to assume that it wasn't that it didn't occur to them that there are only like a dozen people. It was that maybe they intended to come out the gate fancy, but like really be a little bit more workaday going forward.
Yeah. Well, and there's probably people, you know, we could do Fran Lebowitz or, you know, you could get people that have some, you know, your Seth Meyers of the world, Tina Fey. You know, there's people that care about books that wouldn't turn a couple of things like this down. Let me just say, I meant to tell you this, and I'll tell it to you in front of everyone on the internet who cares to listen.
I'm so excited.
Michelle and I watched the Pretend It's a City, the Martin Scorsese.
Oh yeah,
about Fran Lebowitz. And there's, I think it's the last episode that's devoted to her love of books and reading, especially which is she's a cantankerous and fascinating and flawed person, like most of us are. Not me, but
You're definitely not cantankerous.
There's footage of her interviewing Tony. And we remember when the great Morrison passed, that one of the most heartfelt and touching and surprising commendations, elegies, was from Lebowitz. And I remember both of you commenting either in private or on the pod or in some combination thereof. Like, isn't it an interesting odd couple? Wouldn't you watch the Thelma and Louise doc of Tony and Fran bopping around Tribeca back in the day? We're never going to get that. But there's the footage of Tony was genuinely delighted by Fran's whole thing. I want to find it's like in this terrible VHS quality that I know Scorsese probably was like pulling his hair out to have to include, but the footage is so great that he's like, I've got to put it in there. And I'd love to find, it looks like it's some public library interview. I would love to do the whole thing on audio. I don't need to watch a thing. But she was so visibly tickled by Fran's, you know, chaotic, dark energy. And Fran, you know, Fran was trying to press her on something, and Tony was laughing and said, well, you said that, not me. And it was just great. It's everything I wanted it to be, everything I hoped to be, and my sadness of not having Fran and Tony's Guide to Lower Manhattan as a thing I get to watch. It's too bad. But I thought I would pass that along for you and the rest of our listeners.
Love that. I will have to. It's on my Netflix list. I will have to get there sooner rather than later.
You can skip around. You don't need to do all
of
them.
Okay, I may just go
to.
Straight to that.
It's a lot of Fran.
One.
Yeah. It's a lot of Fran. You have to really like New York, and you have to really like someone complaining about New York, which is a particular flavor of ice cream. I'm not sure it's for everyone, but I did find that delightful. You can email us, podcast@bookriot.com, if you've got thoughts, comments. Votes will be closed for a spring preview draft by the time you hear this. It's going to be close. I'll say no more at this particular moment. You can find show notes, bookriot.com/listen. You can also, if you want, thanks for listening. But also, if you want to, go to bookriot.com. And it's a very good website. We like it. We made it. We make it less than we used to. But you can find us there. You can also just search for Book Riot on your podcast player of choice and see all of our lineup of podcasts as well. Also, if you wanted to, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We haven't talked about that in a while. You can do that, especially if they're nice. Especially if they're nice. We would like you to do that. Rebecca, we'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.